play activities over the typical rough play of most boys. Other gay men do not recall this tendency. To make things even more complex, there are plenty of heterosexual men who also remember preferring gentle games over more rigorous masculine boy play. Likewise, just as some of the adolescent boys who exhibit feminine behavior are homosexual, many of them, it ends up, are not. And while some adolescent boys who date and have sexual intimacy with girls later realize they are homosexual, some adolescent boys who engage in homosexual behavior discover they are heterosexual when they become adults. When we try to link boys' early behaviors with their adult sexual orientation, we are often trying to see a cause-and-effect phenomenon when all of science is telling us that there is none. Boys who love sports, enjoy play fighting, and act tough or macho may, as adults, find they are exclusively and happily homosexual. Boys who prefer the nurturing realm of their mothers, who don't like rough play, who relish the same activities as most girls do, may, as adults, be exclusively and happily heterosexual. When we encourage our effeminate sons to toughen up and act more like a man, we are probably doing little that will either increase or decrease a boy's chances of being homosexual. If anything, we are simply engaging in classic gender straitjacketing and thus making our sons feel shame about who they are and what they most enjoy doing. For instance, almost 12 years ago, I was approached for help by 35-year-old Jackie Jefferson, the mother of Kenny, a 15-year-old boy whose peers were constantly teasing him about the kinds of fancy silk shirts he liked wearing and calling him a sissy and faggot. Jackie asked if I would meet with her and Kenny and try to help him with his sexuality issues. In our first meetings together, we worked exclusively on how hard it was for Kenny to deal with the harassment at school, and how difficult it was for Jackie to see her son mistreated in this way. Kenny spoke a lot about how tired he was of being called names, and Jackie expressed how powerless she felt, how she didn't know what she could do to support her son. The sessions seemed to be helpful to both mother and son. After several weeks of meeting together and sharing their struggles with me, Kenny and his mom both announced that things were going better and opted to terminate the therapy. In the end, we never discussed issues relating to sexual orientation, because the heart of what both Kenny and his mother were actually coping with, it turned out, was gender straitjacketing, the boy code, and the shame that gets thrust on boys who do not abide by it. In our sessions, Kenny never raised any thoughts or feelings about loving other boys or feeling attracted to them. He spoke only about being teased for some of his personality traits and personal interests. Kenny, it now turns out, is heterosexual. Just recently, I happened to meet his mother at a local store. She shared not only pictures of a handsome, happy-looking 27-year-old young man, but also shots of Kenny with his wife, Amy, and their newborn daughter, Crystal. Kenny's story shows how one parent who feared her son was dealing with issues related to sexual orientation was actually coping with society's ideas about gender. Of course, the opposite happens, too, because we as a society tend to equate being effeminate with being gay. Some parents fail to notice when a boy who may appear to be classically masculine is actually struggling with his sexual identity. For instance, I was recently approached by Dennis and Sharon Cotton, who wanted me to meet with their son Owen, who, they confessed, seems like he might be depressed. 17-year-old Owen looks very thin to us, they told me, and he spends too much time every day just sulking in his room. When I began my sessions with Owen, the source of his depression was mysterious. He was a tall, well-built young man, and looked more like a college football player than like the emaciated teenager his parents led me to believe would walk through my door. "Your parents sent you here because they're afraid that you are losing weight, maybe not doing so well emotionally." "Yeah," Owen began. "I stopped going to lacrosse practice, and I just haven't been that hungry lately." "Why did you stop going to lacrosse? Did something go wrong in one of the games? Are you having problems getting along with some of your teammates or with the coach?" "No, not really. I was actually voted most valuable player for the last 2 years, and I get along great with everybody. I just don't feel like going anymore." While it took weeks before Owen felt comfortable enough to open up, it turns out that what was getting him down was not a problem doing well at lacrosse, fitting in with his peers, or getting teased for being effeminate the way Kenny once was. Owen was depressed and anorexic, I soon realized, because he was struggling all alone with how much longing he felt for some of his teammates. Longing that was not just for friendship, but for something much more intimate, for something romantic, something sexual. He felt it when he was in the locker room with the other boys, when they won a match and joined in a team-wide hug, when they went drinking together and some of the other boys started acting affectionate. Owen, after weeks of talking to me, discovered that winning the love and affection of other young men was what he really needed to be happy. Owen, it turned out, was gay. Shades of Gray, Bisexuality, Sexual Experimentation, and Boys' Confusion. When a boy first confronts the issue of whether he is homosexual, often the answer may not come easily to him. Though part of his uncertainty may come from his fears and anxieties about what it would be like to lead life as a gay person, it may also arise from his confusion about whether he is homosexual at all. It might be intellectually convenient for us to assume that any given human being is either 100% homosexual or 100% heterosexual, that it's all just a matter of deciding which category one falls into. But there is every reason to believe that homosexuality and heterosexuality are not absolutes, that substantial gray areas exist. Not everybody is 100% homosexual or 100% heterosexual. In addition to people who are bisexual, who feel a strong romantic pull toward people of both sexes, there are many gay people who sometimes have heterosexual feelings or experiences, and many straight people who sometimes have homosexual feelings or experiences. Indeed, if we accept that homosexuals by definition are predominantly attracted to people of the same sex, it is implicit that some homosexuals, or perhaps some small part of almost every homosexual, feels attracted to a certain extent to people of the opposite sex. Likewise, if we accept that heterosexuals by definition are predominantly attracted to the other gender, it must also be true that some heterosexuals, or some small part of almost every heterosexual, feels drawn in one way or another to members of the same sex. Determining our sexual orientation, at the end of the day, is not about finding simple black-and-white answers. Our sexual identity is almost always complex, unclear, confusing. And if it's difficult for us as adults to discover our genuine sexual orientation, our prepubescent or adolescent boys must experience substantial apprehension, ambivalence, and uncertainty. A big part of the confusion that many people experience, stems from the widely held belief that one's sexual orientation can be determined simply by looking at what sexual acts one chooses to carry out. This is misguided, because being gay or straight in reality has to do mostly with what a person feels, rather than with what he or she does at any given time. Just as a heterosexual person is not less heterosexual because he or she does not actually have sex with people of the opposite sex, a homosexual person is not less homosexual because he or she hasn't actually had sexual experiences with somebody of the same gender. The reason this becomes so puzzling for a boy, and often for his parents, is that in many cases a boy may do one thing but feel another. When this happens, he is bound to become unsure about his true sexual orientation. Take, for instance, Scott Schindler, a 17-year-old whose mother Arlene discovered that he and Benson Hawthorne, another teenager who lived just blocks away from the Schindlers, had been getting together in the afternoons, drinking beer, and then masturbating each other. Several years ago, Arlene came to my office for a preliminary meeting. She came without Scott and implored me to do whatever it takes to get Scott to stop this inappropriate behavior. While I explained to Arlene that I would be happy to help Scott examine the feelings he was experiencing, I emphasized that I was not willing to try to change Scott from being whoever he truly was. If your son is gay, which it's not at all clear he is, I'm not willing to try to make him become straight. "That's all right," she replied. "I just want Scott to work through this because neither I nor my husband David know what to make of it. David and I just want Scott to have someone to talk to so that he can figure things out. And I admit that I don't want Scott to continue these encounters with Benson. If Scott agrees that meeting with me would be a good thing, then I'd be happy to try to see him," I replied. At the meetings with Scott, he at first seemed nervous and not terribly interested in talking to me. But as we developed a rapport, he began to open up and share what his life was like. He spoke to me about what he enjoyed and didn't enjoy about school, about girls he had tried to date, about his relatively moderate consumption of alcohol, and about who his closest friends were. In our third meeting, Scott initiated a discussion about Benson. "I know why my mother sent me to see you. She caught me and Benson fooling around, and now she's all freaked out about it." "Are you feeling worried about it, too?" I asked. "Not really," Scott replied. "I mean, we've only done it a couple of times, and it's no big deal." "So you feel positively about your experiences with Benson? You haven't felt down about it at all?" "Well," Scott confessed, "the first time we got together and fooled around, I thought I might be gay. I felt really weird about it. But the truth is, when I hang with Benson and we do stuff together, it's fun and everything, but I'm definitely into girls. I mean, I'm thinking about girls when he and I are together." While at first I wondered whether Scott might have been unintentionally suppressing the truth, that perhaps he might actually be gay, it turned out, after weeks of meeting together, that Scott primarily felt attracted to girls. While he had explored touching Benson's body and had let Benson touch him, the experimentation had more to do with a general need Scott felt to let out his sexual energy than with a true physical attraction to Benson. All of Scott's fantasies were about women. When the junior prom came along, Scott unequivocally decided to take Sharon, a classmate he had had his eye on for several months. Scott's encounters with Benson stopped prior to the end of his junior year, and the last I heard, Scott was living happily with a woman he'd been dating for several years. Scott, as far as I can tell, is heterosexual. When I remember my work with Scott, it's hard not to think, too, of Samson Kim, a 32-year-old patient of mine who worked as a radiologist at a local hospital. Samson came to me while he was still seeing Susan, his live-in girlfriend of 6 years. For his entire life, Samson had had sexual relationships exclusively with women. He enjoyed the feeling of being with women, he explained. But I never felt entirely complete. I always feel like something is missing. As a teenager and a young man, Samson recalled feeling a real pull toward other men. I guess I've never been ready to admit this before, Samson added, but when I think back on it, I've only really fallen in love with guys. I've loved many women, I've loved them dearly, but I've never really been in love with them. I haven't really yearned for them the way I have for some of my guy friends. Did you ever tell any of these men how you felt? I tried to, Samson began, but I always got too afraid. Besides, I figured that since I seemed to like sex with women, I probably wasn't gay. I figured I just felt warmly towards these guys, but that I was basically straight. Samson was propelled to come see me after he met Jason, a handsome, talented heart surgeon who worked at the same hospital as Samson did. Samson's feelings for Jason were so overwhelming that he felt he could no longer simply hide them away. What emerged in our sessions together was that Samson was in fact gay. Because he was a sincere, loving man who cared deeply for the women he had dated, he had experienced a series of important sexual relationships with these women. But when it came down to his real core self, to what truly gave him the greatest joy and satisfaction, Samson longed for men. Samson ended up forming a committed partnership with Jason while continuing a close friendship with his former girlfriend. As we think about how to help boys who feel confused about their sexual orientation, Scott's and Samson's personal stories are important in that they reflect how common it is for people to engage in sexual relationships that do not actually follow their genuine longings. These relationships, in some cases, can last a lifetime. If for some people this results in only a small sense of loss, for others it pushes them to seek secret outside relationships, become anxious or depressed, or suffer other acute physical or psychological problems, such as migraine headaches, insomnia, eating disorders, or substance abuse. It is generally exceedingly painful and unhealthy when human beings suppress their true yearnings. Thus, while it is not at all uncommon for a homosexual man to get married and embark on a life in which the world thinks of him as heterosexual, it would be highly unusual if he was completely happy and fulfilled in living that life. By the same token, if a heterosexual man falls into a primary sexual relationship with another man, even though his essential yearnings are for women, it would be unlikely he would feel entirely satisfied and whole in that same-sex relationship. When parents ask me how to address the confusion boys may feel about their sexual orientation, I encourage them to help their boys talk not only about whom they are attracted to or involved with sexually, but also who their sons like or love. Our boys can only come to the truth about their sexual orientation by examining what the truth is about who they yearn to love, not simply by looking at who they are dating or experimenting with sexually. Because sexual orientation is truly about what is in our hearts, we can help our boys most by encouraging them to be honest with us and themselves about where their true passion lies, who they truly love, and what they really want. What do I say when he tells me he's gay? For a teenage boy who discovers he's gay, perhaps one of the most difficult steps he may have in accepting his own sexuality is mustering the courage to tell his closest friends and family. Because society still has not universally accepted homosexuality, because the gay teenager cannot ignore the hateful homophobic messages he hears around him, he is bound not only to suffer extremely low self-esteem, but also to become exceedingly nervous about how others might respond to his revelation. When he first comes to realize that his primary sexual attraction is toward other males, he may decide to suppress his own feelings in the hope they'll go away. He might turn inward, try to cover any outward signs of his orientation, or engage in acts of self-destruction. The fear that his closest friends and family will reject him is often overwhelming. Telling his parents is especially terrifying, since these are the people he depends on the most, not only for love and approval, but for the very home he returns to each day. "I thought they would disown me," 14-year-old Robert told me. "I thought they'd tell me I wasn't a member of the family anymore." "Just before I was going to tell them," Peter recalls, "I drove my bike to this bridge on the Charles River. I got off my bike and stared out at the river for what seemed like hours. I really thought it might be better to just end everything right there and then, to just plunge into the river. It seemed like it would be easier than having to tell my parents." "I didn't find it in me to tell my dad until he got cancer," Jerome explained. "When he got sick and we knew he was going to die, I wanted him to know who I really was. I was almost 18 years old, an honors student, and headed for Bates on a scholarship, and I was totally in love with Skip Thompson, another guy in my high school class. Dad knew Skip and liked him a lot. I didn't want Dad to die without knowing how happy I was and how close Skip and I had become." Richard remembers how tough it was to tell his mother that he was gay. "When I came home from school in tears one afternoon, my mom asked me what was wrong. The truth was that I couldn't take it anymore. I knew that I was gay, and I hadn't told the two people I loved the most in the whole wide world. My mom is this really great social worker, and my dad's a minister who everyone just loves. They both are really cool about gay issues, but I knew they'd be disappointed if it was me who ended up being gay. But when I saw my mom that afternoon," Richard continued, "I just couldn't hold back the tears. When she saw how hard I was crying, she seemed to know just what to do. She sat me down in our living room, put her arm around me, and told me how much she loved me. When I told her, 'Mom, I'm gay,' I just started crying uncontrollably. I guess I was afraid she'd tell me to leave the house or something. Instead, she just held me tight and said, 'We love you so much, Richard. We'll always love you no matter what. We're very proud of you.'" While there's no one perfect way of responding to a teenage boy when he first tells us that he's gay, perhaps there's nothing more important than reminding him, as Richard's mother did, that we love and cherish him, that we're proud of who he is, that nothing will change in our relationship with him. What a boy fears most is that we will in some way try to shame him, punish him, or send him away. In my opinion, responding in any of these ways would be terribly misguided, since it would be highly likely to traumatize him, to hurt him in a way that he might never be able to forget or forgive. "I haven't spoken with my parents in 10 years, Evan told me despondently, "because when I told them I was gay, they kicked me out of the house. I was only 15 years old and had nowhere to go. I ended up staying with friends of mine who understood what I was going through. When my parents let me move back home a few months later, things were never the same. My father never talked to me, and my mother told me over and over again that in her mind I was just a boarder, that I was no longer her son. I never got over this, and felt bad about myself for years. The only way I could cope was to stop seeing my parents at all. "My parents are old now," Evan explained, "and sometimes they leave a message on my answering machine begging for me to come home to see them. But as much as they want to see me now, I just can't get myself to do it. Whenever the holidays come around, it hurts a lot." While it might be easy to think of Evan's parents as having been thoughtless or uncaring, the reality is that they probably believed that if they withheld their love and affection from their son, somehow he would decide he was no longer homosexual. But sexual orientation is constitutional, an essential part of who each of us is, and is not a decision that we can control or that can be changed by or for our parents. Especially because a boy may be in an extremely tenuous emotional state by the time he finds the courage to discuss his sexuality, I believe it is critically important to convey to him, as soon as he shares his feelings, that he is still loved through and through, that his sexual orientation will not in any way diminish how much he is admired and respected. These are the things a boy needs most to hear. To refrain from saying them is to risk placing a boy in serious emotional, even physical jeopardy, and to risk losing him in one way or another. But if instead a boy is given the love and support he so desperately needs at this critical time, if he is assured that his sexual orientation will never change the way he is thought of or how much he is cared about, we are then doing the best thing we can do to restore his sense of self-worth, preserve his faith that we can be trusted with even his most challenging feelings and struggles, and ensure that his adult romantic relationships, whether he ends up being either gay or straight, will be as happy, healthy, and fulfilling as possible. Only then will he be clear that being a real boy, or becoming a healthy masculine adult, contrary to the myth of boyhood culture, has no relationship whatsoever to whether one is gay or straight. Some thoughts on boys and AIDS. When we broach issues of sex and sexuality with our sons, we cannot help being also concerned about AIDS. As distressing as it is for us to face it, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS, is an extremely serious health crisis affecting millions of young people around the globe. I firmly believe that as reluctant as some parents and some schools may once have been to teach children about sex and sexuality, especially about homosexuality, the reality of AIDS, the reality that it complicates, unravels, and even ends human life, makes teaching our kids about these issues absolutely critical. We must speak to them, and speak to them frankly. The worldwide impact of AIDS has been absolutely devastating. As of December 1997, an estimated 30.6 million people worldwide, 29.5 million adults and 1.1 million children younger than 15 years, were living with the HIV virus or with full-blown AIDS. Through 1997, cumulative HIV-AIDS-associated deaths worldwide amounted to approximately 11.7 million, 9 million adults, and 2.7 million children. And since the beginning of the HIV-AIDS epidemic, approximately 8.2 million children younger than 15 years have been orphaned worldwide because of the premature deaths of HIV-infected parents. Statistics relating specifically to the United States are also staggering. As of June 1997, in the United States, 612,078 cases of full-blown AIDS had been reported to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Of these, 511,934, 84%, were males aged 13 or older, 92,242, 15%, were females aged 13 or older, and 7,902, 1%, were children under age 13. While by now we all know that the HIV virus is blind to sexual orientation, it infects gay people and straight people alike. In the United States, the largest number of men with AIDS contracted it through homosexual sex. According to a 1996 study of men in the United States diagnosed with AIDS, male-to-male sexual contact accounted for the largest proportion of cases, 50%, followed by injection drug use, 23%. But lest any of us conclude that AIDS in the United States is essentially a gay disease, I should emphasize that the transmission of HIV by heterosexuals now accounts for an increasing proportion of AIDS cases in the United States. From 1988 to 1995, the proportion of U.S. AIDS cases attributed to heterosexual conduct each year grew from 4.8% to 17.7%. And AIDS is now the second leading cause of death in the United States among people aged 25 to 44. All of these statistics point to an unassailable fact. We do need to be worried about our children and what they learn about AIDS. Addressing the reality that many adults still hesitate to talk to their children about sexuality and AIDS, Surgeon General Antonia Coelho Novello wrote in the 1993 Surgeon General's Report on AIDS and HIV, "Yes, it is painful to think about the temptations and the dangers they face every day. But sex and drugs are facts of life. We can no longer ignore them than we can death itself. We must prepare our children to face the reality of AIDS in their lives." Indeed, since 1 in 5 of all reported AIDS cases is diagnosed in the 20 to 29-year age group, and since we know that the median incubation period between HIV infection and AIDS diagnosis is nearly 10 years, it's now clear that most of those people in their 20s who are diagnosed with AIDS were probably teenagers when they first became infected. This means, simply enough, that scores of our teenage sons and daughters are being infected with HIV each year, and that by the time they reach their 20s, many of them may develop the symptoms of AIDS. As we've learned in this chapter, many boys feel afraid to talk about their sexuality. If they're gay, many of them are terrified about how their parents, friends, teachers, and others might respond. They fear rejection, even abandonment. And so they go silent. And so we never speak to them about what they're feeling inside themselves. But if colluding in our son's silence, if just letting things work themselves out, might once have been an acceptable option, I simply don't see how it can be any more. We not only owe it to our sons and to our daughters to talk openly about the fears and concerns they have about being sexually active and about whether they're gay or straight, but now we owe it to them to explain what AIDS is all about for homosexuals and heterosexuals, how it is contracted, and what you have to do to make absolutely sure you'll never be infected in the first place. Taking the necessary precautions is easy. Talking about it may be less so. But I believe we simply must overcome our qualms about discussing this. It's nothing less than a matter of life and death. Chapter 10 Schools, The Blackboard Jumble. Girls have an easier time opening up and communicating than guys do. Many guys are afraid to speak up because they don't want to look stupid. Kevin, age 14. School, A Whole New World. It was the first day of third grade for Alexander. He rushed out to the bus stop 10 minutes early, dragging his mother and father with him. He chatted happily with the other kids at the bus stop, and when the bus arrived, climbed aboard without hesitation, with only a perfunctory goodbye peck on his parents' cheeks. He strutted down the aisle and plunked down into a seat next to a child his parents didn't recognize. Both mother and father waved as the bus pulled away, but Alexander was so engrossed in conversation with his unknown seatmate that he didn't return the wave. "What a difference from his first day of kindergarten," his mother remarked to the father as they watched the bus disappear. "I felt like I was abandoning him then. Now I feel like he's abandoned us." That afternoon, his mother asked Alexander who the kid was he had sat next to. "Oh, just a guy I know from last year," replied Alex, and headed toward the door. "Where are you going?" his mother asked. "Nowhere," Alex said. "Don't worry." As every parent quickly learns, school is about a great deal more than learning to read and write and do math. School represents a whole new world, the place where our sons will wrestle with many of the most important social, emotional, and psychological challenges of boyhood. It is where a boy will expand his knowledge, forge relationships, explore his abilities and limitations, and, we fervently hope, build a strong sense of self-esteem. For parents, the prospect of this new world of school is exciting, because they wish to see their children grow and succeed. It is also a matter of some concern, because they know they will now be sharing the task of raising their child with the professionals, teachers, administrators, guidance counselors, and other school staff. From the ages of 6 to 18, our boys will spend the great majority of their waking hours at school. In any given week, a boy may see more of his math teacher than he will of his father or mother. He may spend more time on the school playing field than in the family living room. Especially in today's busy and overstretched families, in which both parents often work long hours or where there is only one parent, school may become the arena where a boy works through many of the challenges of growing up male. Because of the tremendously important role that school plays in a boy's life, I think that parents of a boy should be asking, "Does my son's school have a sufficient understanding of the emotional challenges boys face in becoming confident, successful men? Do the school's teachers and administrators know about the boy code? Do they understand the mask? Are they sympathetic to boys? Does the school teach subject matters and use classroom materials that interest my boy? Does it use approaches to teaching that will stimulate him and make him eager to learn? Is the school a place where my son feels safe, happy and engaged, a place where he'd like to be?" I believe that much too often the answer to these questions is no. Our schools, in general, are not sufficiently hospitable environments for boys and are not doing what they could do to address boys' unique social, academic, and emotional needs. Today's typical coeducational schools have teachers and administrators who, though they don't intend it, are often not particularly empathic to boys. They use curricula, classroom materials, and teaching methods that do not respond to how boys learn. And many of these schools are hardly places most of our boys long to spend time. Put simply, I believe most of our schools are failing our boys. They are failing them in at least four major ways. First, they simply do not appear to be doing a good job at noticing the problems many boys are having in certain academic subjects, namely reading and writing. As a result, many boys are doing extremely poorly in these areas, less well than girls, and their self-esteem as learners is plummeting. Second, our schools and their teachers tend to be poorly versed in the specific social and emotional needs of our sons, and so they often handle these needs inappropriately or inadequately. Many of the specific difficulties boys face that we've discussed in this book, the old rigid boy code, the mask, the vicious cycle of shame and hardening, are poorly understood or completely ignored by many schools. Third, a good number of our schools are not environments that are either warm or friendly toward boys. Especially when boys misbehave, rather than probing behind the misconduct to discover their genuine emotional needs, there's a prevalent tendency to interpret their behavior solely as a discipline problem. Because the myth of boys' toxicity is still deeply entrenched within many school systems, teachers and school administrators are often permitted to become hostile toward boys, and so they may push our sons even further toward academic failure, low self-esteem, conduct disorders, and a host of other emotional and behavioral problems. Fourth, our schools generally do not have curricula and teaching methods designed to meet boys' specific needs and interests. To date, most coeducational schools have done little to investigate how they can make the classroom experience stimulating for boys. They have not developed boy-specific classroom materials. They have not been creative about making the materials they already have interesting for boys. They have not addressed boys' unique learning styles and developed teaching methods that take them into account. And most of our elementary and middle schools have a dearth of male teachers. This sends an early and faulty message to our boys that education and learning are primarily for girls and women. It is understandable that parents put a lot of faith and trust in schools and the people who run them. Depending on how curricula are structured, how classrooms are run, and what essential attitudes about boys prevail, a school can positively shape our boys and their behavioral development. On the other hand, it can confuse them and lead them terribly astray. Research shows that being part of a school that addresses who a boy really is and what he really needs can make a major difference in helping the boy not only to do well academically, but to feel positively about himself and develop a strong, healthy sense of his masculinity. A positive school experience, in short, can bolster a boy's self-esteem. By contrast, attending a school that does not address boys' specific concerns can affect whether our sons will fully realize their academic potential, whether they will succeed at non-academic activities such as sports and the arts, and whether they will find their way to a fulfilling social life. Worse, a difficult school experience may cause our sons to act out in class, suffer depression, become involved with drugs or alcohol, engage in inappropriate or unsafe sexual activities, or become either victims or perpetrators of violence. The quality of our schools may make all the difference for the academic and emotional success of our boys. Many of the schools I visit are trying hard to do well. Many teachers and administrators care greatly about boys. But often because of a lack of resources, or of sufficient and or appropriate training and understanding, a lot of our schools simply don't know how to handle the specific challenges of teaching and supervising boys. They can be hindered in their efforts when they aren't completely knowledgeable about boys, especially when they confuse the psychology of boys with that of girls. That is the subject of this chapter. While it may still seem like a man's world, from the perspective of power and wealth in adult society, in our schools, boys, on the whole, are failing. The Blackboard Jumble. How are schools failing boys as students? There has been a great deal of discussion in the past few years about the relative performance of boys and girls in the classroom. We have been told that schools shortchange girls, fail in providing gender equity and fairness, and actually hinder women's intellectual advancement in society. While these objections have largely been substantiated, I believe that in the heat of the debate about girls, we have failed to analyze how boys are doing in our public coeducational schools. In fact, many boys are not performing well. One of the reasons that boys are assumed to be doing well in school is that many of our most brilliant academic stars are boys, especially in math and science. According to one well-regarded study conducted by educational researchers at the University of Chicago, boys outnumbered girls by about 3-1 in the top 10% of math and science performers. In the top 1%, boys outnumbered girls by 7-1. In some science and vocational aptitude tests, no girls scored in the top 3%. These few boys are the academic superstars, and our focus on them has, I believe, skewed our perception of how boys are doing in general. According to the same University of Chicago study, there is a new gender gap with a predominant number of boys falling to the bottom of the heap. The study, which combined results of 6 major surveys of educational achievement spanning 30 years and involving thousands of children, showed that especially in relation to reading and writing skills, those most basic to functioning in our society, boys are in deep trouble. For reading comprehension, perceptual speed, or word association memory, boys outnumbered girls at the bottom of the scales by a margin of 2-1, and many fewer boys than girls scored in the top 10% of the groups. Another report, entitled The Condition of Education 1997, issued by the U.S. Department of Education, confirms the University of Chicago findings. At all age levels, it states, females continue to outscore males in reading proficiency. This deficiency is particularly disturbing because, as the report itself stressed, reading is a skill that is absolutely critical not only to the boy's progress as a student, but also to his overall lot in life. In addition to their problems with reading, boys are equally dogged by difficulties in learning how to write. The University of Chicago study found such large differences in boys' and girls' writing skills that Larry Hedges, who led the study, concluded that males are, on average, at a rather profound disadvantage in the performance of this basic skill. The Department of Education report confirms this, stating that for the last 13 years, females of all ages have outscored males in writing proficiency. The report characterizes writing as a fundamental skill we need to have not only to learn how to probe and understand ideas and information, but also to motivate others to do so. It also explains that a deficiency in writing skills is likely to undermine one's academic success as well as one's prospects for a meaningful career. From these statistics, you might be tempted to conclude that girls are naturally good at reading and writing, boys naturally good at math and science. But over the years, girls have steadily improved their performance in math and science. So although they are still underrepresented in the very top echelon of performers, they are making steady progress. The same cannot be said of boys and reading. Secretary of Education Richard Riley spoke to Congress in 1997 about these basic reading and writing skills as being make-or-break points, not only in children's education or career achievement, but also in their later life choices. In Riley's words, "Teachers will tell you that poor readers often get down on themselves, become frustrated, and often head down the road to truancy and dropping out. Then things can get worse. Some begin to make the wrong choices about drugs." Boys' weakness in the basic skills of reading and writing contributes to a variety of problems at school. For example, eighth-grade boys are 50% more likely to be held back a grade than girls. And by high school, two-thirds of all special education students are boys. Statistics also reveal that, in general, boys have a greater difficulty adjusting to school life and constitute 71% of school suspensions. What's more, the percentage of boys who attend college has dropped dramatically. 20 years ago, more boys went to college than girls. Today, only 58% of male high school graduates make it to college, as compared with 67% of females. Women earn approximately 55% of all bachelor's degrees granted today, and the percentage continues to grow. Overwhelmingly, recent research indicates that girls not only feel more confident about themselves as learners, but also show more vigor in the steps they take toward developing meaningful careers. For instance, when eighth-grade students are asked about their futures, girls are twice as likely as boys to aspire to a career in management, the professions, or business. A 1993 U.S. Department of Education study found that among high school seniors, fewer boys than girls expect to pursue graduate studies, law, or medical school. 59% of all master's degree candidates are now women, with males' percentages in graduate and doctoral training shrinking each year. These statistics show that there are many more boys at the lowest rungs of the ladder of academic achievement than we had ever imagined or been led to believe. The reality is that although there is an attention-getting handful of star performers, many boys muddle along in the mediocre middle, getting by as average students, and that the bottom of the class actually contains a majority of boys rather than girls. And although the issue of girls and their lagging performance in math and science is now well acknowledged by the U.S. Department of Education, as well as by numerous private educational foundations, and targeted as an area for research and program funding, the problem of boys and their poor reading and writing performance has received little or no attention whatsoever. Boys' poor performance is a global issue. This pattern of academic boy problems is not confined to the United States. It exists across Western Europe and Australia as well. In England and Wales, Girls uniformly score higher than boys in standardized tests conducted at ages 5, 7, 9, and 11. While boys still show some advantage in mathematics scores in the teen years, the major standard achievement measure for 16-year-olds, the GCSEs, shows that 48% of girls versus 39% of boys receive the highest grades in 5 or more subjects. When poverty is factored in, the discrepancy between boys and girls doubles in favor of the girls. In the European Union, more girls complete secondary education, and in most West European countries, they stay on longer in all forms of post-secondary schooling. In New South Wales, Australia, a study found that the majority of special and support class occupants were boys, a finding that sparked a major educational debate. It was also shown that boys performed less well than girls in literacy tests, had lower scores on entrance exams for higher education, and left school earlier than girls. Poor performance leads to a crisis in self-esteem as learners. Behind these disturbing statistics lies what I believe is an irrefutable yet under-discussed reality. Boys have a significant problem with their self-esteem as students. Several well-publicized large-scale surveys have shown a crisis of low self-esteem among adolescent girls. They've revealed that when girls don't feel confident about themselves at school, their unique voices become suppressed, and they begin to suffer emotionally and academically. While the attention these studies have garnered is commendable, I worry that they've led us to conclude that if girls are in trouble, boys must be doing fine. That if girls have low self-esteem, boys must feel confident about themselves as students. I believe that another reason we have failed to recognize boys' low self-esteem is that some of the surveys used to assess self-esteem are not designed to generate accurate results for boys. They ask very direct questions about self-esteem, such as, "Do you feel that you're good at math?" or "How would you rate your reading abilities?" Boys, more than girls, have a tendency to answer such questions in the way they think they are supposed to. In other words, boys know the answers that will make them sound self-confident, as dictated by the boy code, and are quick to respond accordingly. In one study by Edith Nottelman at the National Institute of Mental Health, for example, boys and girls were asked to rate themselves on how well they functioned academically during transitional periods in adolescence. Their teachers were also asked to rate their performance. The largest discrepancies between the students' responses and those of the teachers were always found with the boys. The boys tended to inflate their scores, to brag and puff them up, perhaps because they were ashamed of their weaknesses as learners. The girls' self-ratings, in contrast, were much closer to those of their teachers' assessments. But there are many ways to measure self-esteem, some of which overcome the tendency of boys to brag and overstate their strengths. The Self-Concept as Learner Scale, developed by William Perkey at the University of North Carolina, uses indirect measures to pick up on students' sense of self-image, that is, on how well they feel they are doing within the school environment. When Perkey gave his test to a wide range of students, gifted and average, urban and rural, in grades 6, 7, and 8, he discovered two important facts. First, he learned that for all students, boys and girls alike, this measure of self-esteem lowers as kids move into mid-adolescence, from 6th to 8th grade. but he also reported that significant differences were found between male and female students. Across all grade levels and in all categories, girls scored higher than boys. Put simply, Perkey showed that boys' self-esteem as learners is more at risk than that of girls. Joan Finger, one of Perkey's graduate students, created a similar study to look at African-American middle school students. She discovered no significant differences in self-esteem between African-American and Caucasian boys. However, she found that African-American males had generally lower scores in self-esteem than African-American females. In other words, self-esteem seems to be more an issue of gender than it is of race. Perkey's results differ from those of a widely publicized report called Shortchanging Girls by the American Association of University Women. That report argued that girls have relatively lower self-esteem than boys, while Perkey's findings show that girls, not boys, are the ones who think of themselves as smart enough to succeed. Perkey believes that the disparity comes as a result of boys' tendency toward braggadocio. In his phrase, boys tend to brag more to impress their friends, while girls brag less and do better in school. Boys, he stresses, are simply using bragging as a shield to hide a deep-seated lack of confidence. This shield, of course, is what I call the mask, the emotional defense mechanism boys use to hide their shame. Perkey's findings fit with those of my own work. I tested a group of boys for their performance on the Coopersmith Self-Esteem Inventory, a series of questions designed to measure a child's self-esteem. What I discovered is that, though the boys in my group were functioning quite well on the outside, and their measures of self-esteem were generally at least average, many of them were giving what are known as false positive responses. A false positive response is one where the child thinks he is answering a question in a way that reflects his high self-esteem, but his answer in fact reflects that the child's genuine feelings are different. When a child gives several false positive answers on this test of self-esteem, the researcher knows that the child is not able, for one reason or another, to give sincere responses. Indeed, the false positive scale is actually referred to as the lie measure. Although the boys in my study showed average self-esteem, neither terribly high nor terribly low, not only did many of them give false positive responses, but the extent to which they gave such false positive or defensive responses significantly grew as the boys got older. On a scale from 1 to 8, where 1 suggests genuine responses and 8 suggests false positive ones, the boys scored higher and higher over time. Specifically, boys from grades 7 through 9 scored between 1.53 and 1.95. Boys in the 10th grade scored at 2.45. Those in the 11th grade received 3, and the 12th graders scored a 5. These findings suggest that as boys move through adolescence, they are more and more prone to distort the extent to which they truly feel confident about their masculinity. In other words, as they move through adolescence, they feel an increasing need to say they conform to society's ideal of masculine self-confidence, even though inside themselves they may not feel confident at all. This escalating masking of a boy's real feelings is consistent with the research of Professor Nodelman at NIMH. She studied young teens as they made the transition to secondary schools, assessing what they perceived about their competence and self-esteem as compared with what their teachers felt about them. Boys, Nottleman found, consistently rated themselves more competent than they were rated by their teachers. Her findings, like my own, imply that boys resort to bravado to cover over the shame they would experience if they actually showed their fears about not measuring up. Rather than realizing or expressing their feelings of insecurity, boys whistle a happy tune. This confident tune may fool many adults, and the boys themselves, at least for a while. These studies also suggest that the longer boys are out there in society, in other words, the more they're influenced by society's ambivalent feelings about gender roles and masculinity, the more they feel they have to hide their own confusion by making believe they feel good about themselves when they don't, and by pretending that everything is fine when perhaps it is not so fine. As the years pass, the mask for many boys becomes tighter and tighter. So, while it's not always easy to detect, adolescent boys, just like adolescent girls, are suffering from a crisis in self-esteem that seriously threatens their capacity to learn, achieve, and feel successful. The system does not always fit our boys, the emotional disconnect between teachers and boys. To remedy this predicament, the solution, of course, is not to stop focusing on girls, but to begin focusing more effectively on boys as well. This will not be easy, because I believe that the very structure of most coeducational schools tends unwittingly to favor female students. That teachers have become well sensitized to girls' voices, sometimes at the expense of their ability to recognize boys' voices, and that many educators do not understand boys' characteristic learning styles. Many coeducational schools, I believe, have evolved, due to a variety of societal, cultural, and historical factors, into institutions that are better at satisfying the needs of girls than those of boys. Or these schools have evolved into environments that are essentially gender-blind. Either way, too many schools are failing to address boys' unique social and emotional needs, and are not providing the kinds of classroom activities and approaches that will help most boys to thrive. In a recent study entitled The Influence of School Climate on Gender Differences in Achievement and Engagement of Young Adolescents, Valerie Lee and her associates at the University of Michigan analyzed data on the educational progress of more than 9,000 eighth-grade students. They found that the impact of a student's gender on his or her academic performance was inconsistent. Boys did better in some areas, and girls did better in others. Their more striking discovery, however, was that eighth-grade girls were more engaged academically than boys, evidenced better study habits and better attendance, were more likely to successfully complete their homework, and generally had a more positive set of academically-oriented behaviors. Thus, though girls, as we've seen, may perform below boys in certain limited areas, generally math and science, it seems they are better adjusted to schools than boys are. But is it that girls are better adjusted to schools, or that schools are better adjusted to girls? Consider this example. I was recently asked to consult at a highly ranked suburban public elementary school where the teachers had received compulsory retraining in gender equity. The teachers had become especially vigilant, even obsessive, about making sure that the voices of girls in their classes received ample attention. On several occasions, I had observed the fourth-grade class of Ms. Callahan. She was particularly skillful, modern, and warm in her approach, universally beloved by the students. I have every reason to believe that Ms. Callahan was a teacher who would want both boys and girls to derive all they could from the classroom experience. On this visit, some boys and girls who had been organized into teams were working together on a writing project about friendship. Adult volunteers were consultants for these teams and were helping them with their computer skills. I was surprised to see that instead of focusing on the writing project,